Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Welcome to EIR Talks. It's Tuesday, July 17, 2001, and this is Tony Papert. In a recent show, I told you about Lyndon LaRouche's historic trip to Moscow at the end of June and his testimony before the Economics Committee of the Russian State Duma, or Parliament, on June 29th. The subject of that testimony was the inevitability of the collapse of the present financial and economic system, and the means to avoid the collapse of our nations and populations with it, namely, reorganization of debt, like a Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the United States, the formation of a new fixed exchange rate, gold reserve-based world monetary system, like the best features of the old Bretton Woods system, which functioned from 1945 into the 1950s or 1960s. And to kickstart the world economy, a great project of world infrastructure, industrial, agricultural development, the Eurasian Land Bridge Project, which is a project to build development corridors, including high-speed transportation and agro-industrial development, from the world's industrial centers in Europe into the world's population centers in Asia, East Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia. A few days after appearing in Moscow, LaRouche traveled to northern Italy at the invitation of businessmen's groups there and addressed two meetings in the northern Italian industrial city of Vicenza. What we'll see in today's show is LaRouche's talk to the Chamber of Commerce and Industry of Vicenza, July 3rd of this year. You'll see that in that address, he expands on the themes which he developed in Moscow. In the days since LaRouche spoke in Moscow and in Italy, the explosion of the Argentina crisis has again confirmed, in a way which I'll begin to describe, the inevitability of the collapse of this world economic and financial system. Now, Argentina is a company which privatized. Argentina is a country which adhered to free trade. Argentina globalized, and yet the country is bankrupt and is considered likely imminently both to default on its national debt and to be forced to devalue its currency, which may drop perhaps as much as fivefold from its present value. This is an Argentina which got a $40 billion IMF package as recently as December 2000 and underwent a $30 billion debt reorganization as recently as June. If you take Argentina's really $212 billion in debt, the official estimate is $130 billion, combine it with Brazil, with Mexico, you have $1 trillion of third world debt set to go. That brings down the entirety of $10 trillion of third world debt, and that brings down the $400 trillion world derivatives bubble of speculative gambling type debts, mostly between and among the major banks. Add Turkey, which is in precisely the same situation as Argentina. What you have now is a debt crisis like the so-called Asia crisis of 1997-98. Remember that that led to a Russian default in August 98, and that in turn led to the almost collapse of the whole system in October 1998, when the world's biggest hedge fund, LTCM, disposing of $1 billion of credit, would have gone under but for the intervention of Alan Greenspan's Federal Reserve to bail it out, in effect, with taxpayer money. The difference between today and 1998 is that no longer is the U.S. economy and the European economy in the phony information technology bubble prosperity, which, of course, Lyndon LaRouche said at the time was phony, as we now see it was. Now, the economies of Western Europe and the U.S. are verging on free fall in the midst of this new debt crisis. It's not an Argentina crisis. It's not a third world crisis. It's a systemic crisis of the whole system. And the proof of that is that whatever you try to do within the parameters of privatization, globalization, free trade, the IMF system, whatever you try to do within those parameters to rescue the Argentina debt will only make the problem worse. For instance, if Argentina devalues fivefold, as is likely to happen soon, the result will be to help bring on a dollar collapse crisis. LaRouche says without any equivocation, we're heading for a dollar collapse crisis, we're heading for a euro collapse crisis. Witness the fact that immediately after LaRouche's trip there, Russia has reintroduced a gold-backed ruble, called the chervonets, from the 1920s, as an alternative to dollar savings by Russian citizens. They can put it into a safe gold-backed ruble. Note that they're not going from the dollar to the euro. They're going to a gold instrument, which could possibly be a transition, again, to gold reserve-based currencies for international trade. So we'll go from here to Lyndon LaRouche's address, the Chambers of Commerce and Industry in Vicenza, Italy, northern Italy, the Veneto region, on July 3rd, 2001.
I'm glad to be here. I'm very favorably impressed by the performance of the entrepreneurial interests in this section of Italy. They are of a especially useful type in this time. We must now face reality. We are in the process of the largest collapse in world finance and world monetary affairs in modern history. In European experience, the nearest comparison to what's happening now is the collapse of the Lombard bankers' system in the middle of the 14th century, with the effects that had on the demographic characteristics of the European population. Over 30% of the population of Europe vanished, half of the parishes of Europe vanished, and other things happened during that period. That led, of course, largely through initiatives of Padua, into the 15th century Renaissance. But I would hope we don't have to wait so long for the Renaissance from this particular catastrophe. And there's no reason so why we had to. As to exactly when the collapse will occur is somewhat uncertain, though I can assure you that it's now. It is oncoming now. And nothing can save the present world monetary and financial systems in their present form. The world system can exist only under a radically changed form of system, which amount to a return to the relations between the United States and Western Europe during the period 1945 through 1964, approximately. That would mean a return to a fixed monetary system, fixed rate monetary system, a protectionist system with trade controls, capital controls, financial controls, and so forth. All the things you need as provisions to launch a quarter century long rebuilding investment for rebuilding process and rebuilding of world trade. That is merely a matter of the will of governments, which will be tested by a crisis which in its present form cannot be stopped. So either governments have the ability to force those changes into being, or we are going to be in the worst financial depression worldwide in modern history, and that will be very soon. The difficulty in predicting the exact time is that historical processes are not statistical processes. They are not determined by statistics. They are determined by the intervention of the human will. But the processes give the human will certain opportunities to make decisions to survive or not to survive. And as the pressure increases, the human will is tested. Will it make the changes? If it doesn't, things become worse. If it does, things can become better. That's our present situation. The best comparison for the present situation is Germany, 1923. In the early 1920s, French bayonets occupying part of Germany, the Rhineland, were looting Germany on demanding full and prompt payment of war reparations demands adopted at Versailles. Germany agreed to print money to pay the French in particular for the war reparations debt on schedule. Germany was paying more to the French than Germany was earning. But the Germans covered that deficit by printing money to make up for what Germany was not earning and could not pay. Until the spring of 1923, because Europe was under a strong deflationary pressure, there was not a significant rate of growth of inflation of prices and commodities within Germany itself. Beginning approximately the beginning of July 1923, a hyperinflation began. If you look closely at the figures of that period, there was one development which set off the hyperinflation. At the point that the attempt to roll over debt by printing money resulted in an increase in the amount of money printed to roll over existing debt, you had an automatic hyperinflationary spiral, such that from the beginning of July until the beginning of November 1923, the German Reichsmark evaporated in a famous hyperinflation explosion. What is happening now is the United States and a Japan which is intimidated into supporting the United States with the yen carry trade is flooding the world with money to support the U.S. dollar. The U.S. is running at a deficit. The current account deficit is approaching $1 trillion a year. It's at least $600 billion, probably much more. In addition, several trillions of dollars a year in net financial inflows into U.S. markets are sustaining U.S. financial markets. Not all of them, but some of them. The result of this has been that the role of the United States as an importer of last resort for Asia, for South and Central America, to some degree Europe, has collapsed. Therefore, we are in a world trade collapse caused by a collapse of the U.S. importing, a collapse of the ability of the United States to continue to import. Therefore, it's merely a matter of time before one of the two things happens. Either a simple collapse occurs, chain reaction collapse, or there is a hyperinflationary explosion coming out of the dollar. We're already in a hyperinflationary phase in the United States. The rate of inflation in the United States is actually today in excess of 10% per year. In some categories, it's 20, 30, and 40% per year. We have a worldwide inflationary trend in energy prices and some other characteristics. We have an instability in the transfer of the D-mark into the euro scheduled for the first of this year, which could be a point of explosion of the European system. So all of these things are here. Therefore, we have a certain amount of flexibility exactly when we choose to die. But the death is imminent unless we make the changes we have to make now. And my function is to try to bring about those changes in a timely fashion so we don't go into a new dark age. Once we admit the problem, then we can begin to become optimistic. Because as in this area, if you look at the industry of this particular area, and I've given some attention to it, it has certain characteristics which are exemplary and among the best in Italy for export activities. It's an entrepreneurial system. It is not a big corporate financial structure. It has much more competence in its management than the big corporations of the United States and Western Europe generally, because they're inflated. They're in business to make money through finance, not to make business through competence in production of product. Here I see, in these entrepreneurial industries, we see a tendency for high technology competence in delivering a product to customers both domestically and internationally, especially the emphasis on machine tool-oriented entrepreneurial industries. These are the very best and strongest kinds of enterprises for the immediate future and for trade abroad. For example, let's take any typical company here, which is in the machine tool area of production. It can easily go into other parts of the world, say Russia, for example. where I just had some discussion of this before the, where I testified before the Duma on these matters. In Russia, you have a lot of potential in terms of scientists, other skills. You have, in this part of Italy and some other parts of Italy, you have industries which are capable of establishing special kinds of partnership with Russian partners. Go in and find a Russian scientist, a Russian technologist, Russians who are in business, work with them to share different technologies back and forth. You not only can export a technology into a place like Russia, but you can also get scientific and technological benefits from technology sharing back and forth with your trading partner. This is the strongest and best type of opportunity that you can have in any part of the world today. The day of the big giant corporation, which has abandoned machine tool, emphasis on machine tool technology and science, that kind of corporation, the one that tries to sell automobiles like dresses, that kind of cooperation is going to be reorganized and change its habits. It has not got a good future. Firms like those in these areas have a much better ability to withstand crises of the type now hitting us. All right, now Italy is also fortunate in one respect. In the struggle to get a reform of the international monetary system, the political class in Italy has a better performance than the nation of any other part of the world. If you look at the number of resolutions on a general reform of the monetary system and related kinds of reforms which have come out of the Senate, out of the Chamber of Deputies in Italy, you will find that there's more progress toward reform of the international monetary system presently than you find in any other part of the world in terms of political systems. We also have going on, you should watch it closely, in a recent meeting in Shanghai, involving the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and some others, there was a change in a group which was previously called the Shanghai Five. This group has now been expanded to become the Shanghai Cooperation Council. This is not in itself a revolutionary institution. It's simply a new, more intimate form of cooperation among a number of countries. However, this group overlaps what is called the ASEAN Plus Three group, which is a group of China, Japan, Korea, and the nations of Southeast Asia. This group is moving toward the direction of, and has threatened to do this, to create an Asian Monetary Fund, which would be an internal facility for generating credit for large-scale products. We have now, through the cooperation among Russia, China, and India as three key partners, we have new degrees of cooperation on economy. None of these things are yet settled, but they are steps in the right direction, and they're very important steps. You also have a tendency in Western Europe, notably in Germany and in Italy in a different form, tendencies for European continental nations to find partnership in Eastern Europe and in Eurasia generally. The general possibility here is to build up through emphasis on scientific and technological progress and related machine tool technologies, to build up production in countries which have, or sections of the world, which have high technology capabilities, to build them up as partners with sections of Eurasia which have poorer technological potential. And thus, if the nations involved can come to 25-year agreements at 1 to 2% simple interest credit through state-guaranteed credits run through private banks and other facilities, but credits run on the basis of state cooperation on up to a 25-year period, it is perfectly feasible to have a general expansion in Eurasia through trade from those areas which represent the export of technology to those parts of Eurasia which represent the import, the potential for the import of technology. This cooperation in Eurasia would then mean that Africa and the Americas could participate in that process, and we could bring about a worldwide recovery over the coming quarter century. That's the good side. I've been working on this for some years, and we proposed what is called a Eurasian land bridge. That means developing corridors which are not just transportation corridors, but corridors about 100 kilometers width across Asia, which are transportation, power, and development areas. For example, in Central and North Asia, that is Central Asia and the tundra areas of northern Russia, we have vast resources, natural resources, which are waiting for development, but cannot be developed economically because we do not have the adequate infrastructure in that area to develop them. Therefore, if we develop three or four routes of major development corridors across Eurasia, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, we can make a revolution in the history of the world, in the economic history of the world. Because if you can move freight at 300 kilometers per hour, optimal speed, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and move that freight through development areas in which the existence of the development area is promoting increase of production of wealth, then the cost, the movement of that freight across Eurasia costs you nothing in net effect. That is, the growth in the economy you get from the development corridor is far greater than the cost of moving the freight. And therefore, it is the improvement in the economy which meets the cost. If you could move freight at 300 kilometers per hour, optimal speed, through magnetic levitation transport, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, you no longer depend upon ocean travel as the major vehicle of moving freight. If you also extend that to the bridge which is proposed, a bridge tunnel complex across the Bering Strait, then you have united Eurasia with the Americas in the same kind of system. You extend the system in the Americas down through South America, and you have essentially integrated the planet, if you include development routes into Africa. That's the great opportunity before us, and that a vision like that should be what determines our long-term perspective for the quarter century to come. Italy's role in this is interesting because, as I indicated, Italy's attitude on monetary reform has been a moral factor, a very important moral factor in the world situation. The Italian motion to repeal some of the debts for the poorest developing countries, motions for a new Bretton Woods system, that is to return to something based on the model of the pre-1964 Bretton Woods system, a relationship between Europe and the United States as a model. This has given Italy a special position in this respect. And I think that initiatives from Italy in this direction, have indicated, will be more and more well-received in various parts of the world, including potentially in Russia, if Russia straightens its problems out. So there are several. What we have to do is develop certain projects. You have to have a monetary system which enables you to grow. But as Kepler pointed out in terms of a planet, it is not the statistical inertia of an orbit that determines whether or not a planet moves in its orbit. Similarly, it is not an accounting plan or a monetary plan which enables a general economic recovery to occur. There must be, as Kepler said of the planetary system, there must be an intention that moves the system. Therefore, in order to have a recovery, you must have a framework, a monetary accounting framework, which enables you to sustain long-term investment and long-term extension of credit. But you must have, at the same time, you must have a sense of mission and intention which is going to motivate you to take advantage of the design of the system. Now, in the case of France under the Fifth Republic's President Charles de Gaulle, the term used to describe this was called indicative planning. That is, to make an economy work, and our experience of large projects, our experience of the great periods of wartime and other mobilization show us this. In order to make a good, sound economic plan work, that is, in terms of monetary and accounting terms, to make it work, you must have some sense of specific missions around which you're going to mobilize the resources of people, including their governments. And that's how you make things work. For example, adoption of new technologies. The history in Europe, beginning in the United States, actually, the adoption of the railroad as a motor force for economy, which occurred in the 1820s in the United States, and then spread into Europe from there, is an example. The idea of developing transcontinental railways, which were introduced in the United States, particularly and made functional under Abraham Lincoln, was copied in Europe from 1876 on as a general revolution in European economy, affected directly by Bismarck's Germany in 1877, affected between 1878 and 1879 in Japan, affected in Italy with the renewal of Italy in the time of Cavour. The same kind of thing, projects, the great influences of people like Betti, who was a partner of a collaborator of the great Riemann, typifies the sense of mission. We have the hydrodynamic school of technology in Italy, which was a sense of mission, which gave Italy its impetus in economic growth during the late 19th and early 20th century. So these projects are necessary. Nuclear energy was a mission. Development of magnetic levitation transportation systems is a mission. The improvement of higher energy flux density power production is a mission. The improvement of cities is a mission. Several possibilities of revolutions in agriculture are a mission. The idea of, in general, the idea that all men are created equal, morally, in potential, and that a just system is one which utilizes the full potential of the human individual and develops that potential, is a sense of mission. Purposes, principles adopted by governments and among governments, which cause people to mobilize their resources both in as governments for basic economic infrastructure and also in private entrepreneurial activity. This is something that the world is ready for. We can produce something to contribute to benefit that. This kind of sense of mission is what makes it work. And if states organize systems of credit among nations, within nations, if national banking arrangements exist to ensure that local private banks and so forth have access to the trade credit through which they can make long-term contracts for their customers in other countries and their own country, and these ideas prevail, then we can succeed.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
We come to an interesting point which I took up in Moscow. In addition, I went to Moscow last week on invitation to testify before the Duma Economic Commission, the Economic Section of the Duma, on the question of economic reform, the world financial system. And while I was there, I was invited to a leading scientific institution of Russia, the Lebedev Institute, where I took the opportunity of giving the scientists a little kick on the subject of the implications of the work of a great Russian scientist, Vladimir Vernadsky, who is the man who invented the word noosphere, one of the great intellects in biology and other fields. And geology as well. One of the interesting things in Russia and the Asia in general is if we seek to develop Central Asia and North Asia which includes a tundra area and largely desert or semi-desert areas, and include areas like Xinjiang in China and adjoining areas, which are desert areas. If we seek to develop these, we have to change the infrastructure. Now, infrastructure generally means the government or governments create large-scale projects which are either funded and controlled by governments, or they are controlled by governments but they're private utilities operating under government's protection. This should occupy usually 60% of the total throughput of any healthy modern economy. This includes obvious things such as transportation, water management, production of power, delivery of power. It involves considerations such as general education, health care. Physicians may practice in private, but without the guarantees that you have the medical institutions, medicine cannot be implemented. Schools may be partly private, but without the commitment to certain standards of education, education doesn't function. To get education, which is the medium by which people develop potentials for scientific work, does not work unless you combine those institutions with scientific discovery, unless you hitch institutions of higher education and scientific discovery to the machine tool practice, unless you have a constant spillover from discovery of science and development of technology into industrial production, the economy really doesn't work. All of these things represent basic economic infrastructure, including urban infrastructure, things of that sort. So, in going into Central Asia, vast amounts of water, largely wasted, going in the wrong place, large areas, vast mineral resources, probably the largest on this planet as a whole, which can generally not be reached for development. We are going to make the greatest change in the biosphere ever imagined. And that is the challenge immediately before us of this integrated development of Eurasia. Now, to do that, we have to be sensible. We have to be intelligent. We cannot be fools. Therefore, we have to accelerate our emphasis on the science of infrastructure, the science of biosphere, the science of noosphere. We can eliminate a few other subjects we spend too much time studying in universities and put our attention on these things instead. But we have to have a sense of mission, that if we are going to undertake the most revolutionary change in the biosphere this planet has ever experienced, we better find out what we're doing and do it competently. And this, I think, is one of the great indicative senses of mission which should motivate us all today on this planet. I don't care whether you're in Italy or South America or wherever. What might happen to the planet because of your failure to develop Central Asia and North Asia competently is something you should worry about if you think about the future. And Vernadsky was the person who opened our eyes best to that kind of concern, as well as some other things. So that's, in general, what I would sum up the situation. We have the greatest crisis in human history before us, in modern history. The question of whether civilization will survive is on the table. It's on the table for the immediate decades ahead, and right now as well. We have at the same time the options, if we use our heads, if governments use their heads, to deal with this crisis, to change with the monetary and financial practices of the planet, to reorganize our relevant financial and related institutions, revise our laws, dump globalization and other pieces of insanity, get back to what we knew was a traditionally sound economy in Europe and the United States between 1945 and 1964. Get back to that. Under those conditions, we can do very well. But to do well, we must learn to cooperate better in the world as a whole. Instead of trying to resolve conflicts among nations, we should try to eliminate a conflict orientation in relations among nations and find cooperation instead. We must have a sense of mission for the planet as a whole. We must think at least a generation ahead as to what kind of a planet we want to leave to the next generation, a generation ahead. And we have to have some very concrete senses of mission orientation in terms of project orientations, jobs to be done. And that said, I think what I've seen in this region of Italy you will do the right thing and do it very well. Thank you.
In the following segment, LaRouche gives a 20-minute answer to a question involving the depth of severity of the present world financial and economic crisis.
Well, I can tell you generally that all the central banking systems of Europe and the United States are bankrupt, hopelessly so. There's no possibility. This includes Swiss banks and so forth. It includes UBS, Credit Suisse, First Boston, every major bank of the United States, and practically every major bank of Europe. Probably the biggest factor in the current bankruptcy of these banks is the crazy telecommunications speculation which has run in the recent years. The so-called new economy was the greatest fraud in modern economics. It was actually a John Law financial bubble. It was not a technology bubble, though a lot of people believed in it. Communications are fine, computers are fine as auxiliaries for accounting and other practices and certain scientific practices, but computers do not produce money. Contrary to Norbert Wiener, John von Neumann, and Bertrand Russell, it doesn't work. The problem here is that we are going to have to put the entire private banking system, especially the central banking systems, into financial reorganization and replace them with national banking in the sense of Alexander Hamilton's conception of national banking. In other words, the world is bankrupt. The world's money intrinsically is worthless at this moment. The central banks are hopelessly bankrupt. They could never work their way out of bankruptcy under present conditions. The central banking system, like the Federal Reserve System, is bankrupt. We have an insane chairman of the Federal Reserve System, Alan Greenspan. He's insane. He's pumping inflation. Europe is going to move more and more independently of the United States as long as Bush is in power, because he's insane, functionally insane. Forget what his psychiatrist says. His behavior, his policies, his policy making is insane. And most everybody in Europe says so privately, and many say it so publicly. The same thing is in Asia. So the first thing is national banking, which means that remember, what is a currency? There's no such thing as an original currency. Marx was crazy on the question of the so-called original hoard of gold. It's nonsense. There's no original coin. Look at the history of, this is Italy. Look at the history of the Lombard banks. Professor, I'm sure, has studied the Venetian history from that period and how the Venetian fondi ran the Lombard banks. And what that did to Europe during a period in English history, from the accession of Henry II in England, through the end of the Plantagenets, with the collapse of Richard III centuries later. So there is no such thing as natural money. There is no such thing as a natural currency. There is no such thing as an original hoard of money, contrary to Marx. Money is political. And especially since the arise of the modern nation state, beginning from the time of Peter Abelard, through the formation of the first modern nation state in France under Louis Onze, and then later in England under Henry VII. With the emergence of the modern nation state, the authority of private interests to create money and to regulate it was over. Unfortunately, we returned to this business of private controlled central banking. It should not work. It should never have been allowed. Every time we did it, we got into serious trouble. The same kind of trouble which we should have learned from studying the reasons for the collapse of the Lombard banking system. And if you look back at the history of the houses of Bardi and Peruzzi and look at why they collapsed in the 13th and 14th century practices, you would understand more clearly what is happening to us today. So what I'm proposing, I think the president does not appreciate how radical I am. What I'm proposing is something much more radical. You have to uproot certain things. First of all, you have to restore the currency under the control of national banking. That is government. Now, the problem in Europe, of course, is you have a kind of government which we don't have in the United States, constitutional government. You have not in Europe, except for one period under de Gaulle, an attempt of a real federal republican government. You have a combination of a parliamentary system with a president who takes the place of a king, or temporary king, with much less power than a temporary king. So, at least on the parliamentary systems, it is sometimes difficult, which means that you, in a European system, in a parliamentary government, you have to make certain constitutional, radical and immediate constitutional provisions to establish an executive under which you can have an orderly creation and management of a national currency. This would be like creating a heavy lira, for example. Say 1,000 for one or 2,000 for one. The creation of a heavy currency, which is then defended by the government. The government then does not issue as much money. The government issues credit. Credit in the terms of long-term credit. The government authorizes the National Bank to issue money on behalf of the government, but to issue credit for borrowing that money, and then extends the credit for approved categories of investment and purposes through the National Bank, according to law, through private banking and other institutions, or foreign treaty agreements. That's how you get an economy organized. So we need that. That's the first thing. And then we can throw away all the theory that goes with Keynes and others in terms of how central banking system should function. Eliminate the problem. It's like you eliminate a cancer. Don't try to manage the cancer. Sometimes eliminate it. This is the case of eliminating it. We'll have to if we wish to survive. Now, look at the case of Asia, because I think a certain injustice was said about Japan and Korea. Japan was a very successful economy in the post-war period, especially under the arrangements which were instituted under the administration of General MacArthur as the administrator. And Japan went back to what Japan does well, which it learned from history. It went back to looking at markets in Asia for long-term credit for purchase of capital goods and infrastructure development for that region. Now, in the 1970s, a change had occurred in U.S. policy. Generally, I say I have many criticisms of U.S. and European policy, and joint policy, Western European policy, over the period 1945 through 1964. There were many mistakes were made. But, as you know in Italy, you look at the history of Italy, despite all these mistakes, there was a systemic, steady net progress in the physical condition of the economy, the improvement of the conditions of life of the people. For example, take the history of the Casa di Mezzogiorno, which in its early phase was successful, and its later phase, under crisis conditions, became actually nothing but a farce, even in the mind of those people who were assigned to lead it. They say, it's helpless, we can't do anything that we should be doing in the Casa di Mezzogiorno. So you had a period in which, despite all the mistakes, things worked to the effect of a net improvement in the conditions of life and health of the economy. Then there came a time when things didn't work. Now, the inception of that was about 1966. It started with the Indochina War, the United States Indochina War, which was the turning point down. But the economy still functioned for a few years. Then we had a very unfortunate thing. And this will take a few minutes, but I think you find it worth your while. The United States has not just two major parties, it has two major factions which cut across both leading parties. One party, which is so called by Franklin Roosevelt, were the American Patriots, the tradition of that current of thought, which was European, predominantly influenced by the tradition of Gottfried Leibniz, and also the tradition of the 15th century Renaissance, the American patriotic tradition. Now, this cuts across parties. At one point, even Lincoln, when he led the Republican Party, when he was an example of the American patriotic tradition, nonetheless had in the New York and New England Republican Party, he had some of the worst people you could imagine. And they're still bad. They haven't improved since. The Democratic Party, from its inception, its founding in the 1820s, until Roosevelt, was a party of racism and treason. It was called the American Tory Party. Now, in the 20th century, particularly with the takeover of the Republican Party by Teddy Roosevelt, Roosevelt's cousin and enemy, and Woodrow Wilson, the racist, the man who refounded the Ku Klux Klan as president, that under these conditions, both parties became a mess. You had the Democratic Party has some decent people in, some very good people in the Roosevelt tradition, as they call today, the Franklin Roosevelt tradition. The Republican Party has some people in, very good people, also in the American patriotic tradition. But what happened in 1966? Backed by the Rockefellers, Richard Nixon ran a campaign on what was called the Southern Strategy. The Southern Strategy was based on an alliance between New York financial interests, New York-centered financial interests, which include Washington, D.C., Boston, Philadelphia, and so forth, and the tradition of the Confederacy, the racist tradition. From 1966 to 1968, the United States was dominated by a pro-Vietnam War, pro-racist alliance called the Southern Strategy. Nixon was entirely that. Nixon was virtually a fascist. He never turned the United States into a fascist state, but he personally was a fascist. That tradition continued. In 1976, Carter was elected president. Carter was a Democratic version of Nixon. He represented the Southern Strategy. Now, if you find a pattern of changes in U.S. policy, financial and monetary policy, 1966 to 1968, and then especially under Nixon first, then Carter, and then under very contradictory president, Reagan, and the influence of Bush. And that tradition has continued. Now, I had fairly close relations with the Clinton administration, and liked Clinton personally, though I had my differences with him. But I know that from that relationship that he wanted to make certain changes for the better, but felt that he was incompetent to make those changes. Did not have the support, and he even said a few times, I think they'd kill me if I tried. So the problem in the United States is not just simply an economic problem. It's the fact there was a change in policy by the United States as a dominant power, typified by the first Wilson administration and the second Wilson administration in England, typified by the Thatcher administration in England, and typified by the president, whoever he is, the prime minister or prime something or other in England. And these tendencies are the political tendencies of an Anglo-American complex, which has allies and co-takers in many parts of the world, and institutions, which have destroyed the economy of much of the world. That is, if we had continued muddling along as we were with the policies we had up to 1964, Europe and the United States would have survived fairly well, because we would have had the policy impulse to do things, the reflexes, to make correct our mistakes. The influence of this Southern Strategy tendency in the United States and comparable things in Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand have created an Anglo-American alliance, which has come, especially since the collapse of the Soviet system, to dominate the world without opposition, without effective opposition. And that is what this problem, this is what this crisis is we face. So there are many technical things that have to be understood about it, but you have to understand the political power factor behind this. We're now, and obviously, let's go in the case of Japan and Korea, in that context. In the 1970s, the United States, under Henry Kissinger first, and then by Kissinger's spiritual cousin, Brzezinski second, under Carter, said first to Iran, you will not develop with Japan. The Shah of Iran had an agreement with Japan on oil for technology to make Iran the Japan of the Middle East by having a guaranteed arrangement between petroleum from Iran in exchange for technology from Japan. This was shut down. You know the coup against the Shah of Iran was orchestrated for that reason. Stop that. In the same period, Japan had a similar agreement with the governor of Mexico. And in 1976, when Brzezinski was coming in as a national security advisor under Carter, he threatened the Japanese and the Mexicans. They had an agreement on technology, including steel industries, for petroleum. The government of Japan, the government of Mexico, had agreed upon it. Brzezinski shut it down. The agreement was made then, Japan, you will not continue. Your policy of trying to ship heavy technology into developing countries, you will now produce products, consumer products and similar projects, to supply markets in the United States and Western Europe, and especially the United States. The same thing was done to Korea. So therefore, the problems, the mistakes of Japan and Korea are a result of the imposition of power for wrong policies on Japan. Now at the point, Japan and Korea, the patriots of Japan and Korea are in a state of readiness to revolt from Anglo-American domination. This has been the China, which thought it could deal with Bush, has come to the point that it knows it's going to have to revolt against the Bush phenomenon. Russia is playing a keystone role among nations which otherwise would not tend to cooperate. It's difficult to get, for historical reasons, to get Japan to cooperate with Korea, Japan with China, and so forth and so on, or India with China. These are conflict-ridden relations. Only if you have multi-party relations among nations in which their common interest overrides their traditional conflicts can you bring them together for any kind of long-term cooperative agreement. And that's what's in process. You have, for example, in Europe, you have the impetus of Italy and its political system to try to find an aperture into cooperation with Eurasia. And Italy does generally a better job with small firms than anybody else does in this field. You find the relations between Putin and Chancellor Schroeder of Germany very similar. And that's the problem. Generally, I would make this observation in general. As I've written a piece on this subject recently, it's a long piece and it's an important piece, and it's important because of who I am in the United States, among other things. But you have to understand, as I do, looking back as a somewhat older man, I think there's one or two people who may be older than I am, but most of you aren't. And you say, what went wrong? We had quasi-democratic governments, at least. Why did we, as a people, allow these changes to be made, which have almost destroyed us? Why did we allow this? We say popular opinion demanded it. We couldn't fight popular opinion or political trends or whatever else we call it. I call it Vox Pox. And the phenomenon, the way it works, is that I use this image. Imagine the goldfish in a bowl. You know the legend about the goldfish bowl. It's not true, but it's a good legend. If you dump the goldfish out of the goldfish bowl into a pond, it will continue to swim in small circles, as if it were in a bowl, rather than swimming freely in the pond. This is the way human beings behave. This is the way Vox Pox works. That if people are conditioned to believe that the goldfish bowl is a bowl, not a pond, they will swim in that way. And it's because people are conditioned to accept certain habits of belief imposed upon them that they continue to behave in a suicidal way. The reason that what I do sometimes causes such shocks is because I do the obvious. You know the story of Hans Christian Andersen, of the Emperor's New Suit of Clothes. The story was that these two came to the Emperor and promised they could make him the most magnificent clothes in the world. But they're so beautiful that they were invisible to him. So they made these clothes, and he wore them in the street, walked down the street naked. And the population of Denmark admired these clothes immensely, until a little boy on the sidewalk said, "But Daddy, he has nothing on!" And that's pretty much the way our economies function. We function in societies, which, because we choose to believe certain things, because we believe it's just like the Roman citizens under the Caesars, or even before, the phenomenon of vox populi, of the popularity, who were marched into the Colosseum or the Circus Maximus or the Hippodrome and marched in to watch Christians being eaten by lions and cheering. And that had bred in circuses, controlled the Roman population, the popularity. That the same methods of fabled illusions, largely orchestrated by mass media, affecting our society, control the mass behavior of people in society and the individuals within them. And thus, when something ought to be obviously wrong and should be obviously corrected, people say, you can't go against popular opinion. And that's what killed us. What the significance of this politically is, we've come to a point when popular opinion is about to be discredited. That happened the last time in my experience, significantly in 1931-32, when the illusions of the Coolidge era of the 1920s in the United States collapsed. And Franklin Roosevelt came along and at a certain point said, the common man, the general welfare, and the majority of the population of the United States suddenly turned and made a kind of revolution in U.S. policy, returning to the concept of the general welfare. That's my politics in the United States today, is that I think you must think boldly, you must think truthfully, you must think scientifically. But whatever must be done for the benefit of the people and nations must be done. We cannot allow civilization to be destroyed. And the problem is when are people going to reach the boiling point, so to speak, at which they will make a decision based on their judgment, not based on what they think are prevailing opinions.
In a future show, you will hear about an EIR exclusive report on the Sharon plan for Mideast war exposed by Jeffrey Steinberg. You've been watching EIR Talks. Please tune in again next week.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.